Welcome to the seventh episode of the Statistically Insignificant Podcast. I'm your co-host, Jared, and I'm here with my other co-host,
Eric Drysdale.
Today, we have a special guest on. It's my fiance, Jasmine Knox.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Jasmine. Yeah, so I actually asked Jasmine on today because Jasmine works in an industry that's been particularly hard hit with COVID. She works in the live event industry in theater. And that's an industry that I also kind of heralded from. I worked for a couple of years in that, but you work as a production manager. And I was hoping that you could maybe give us and the listeners a bit of an insight into what that entails.
Sure. So production managers deal with the sort of the background elements of a show, set, costume, lighting, sound. Basically, our main job is to make sure that the whole show happens on time and on budget.
It's an interesting job position because A, there's not very many theater production managers out there. So I wonder, like, what background drew you into this, or what experiences, and how did you end up in this kind of role?
I didn't actually know what a production manager was before I went to theater school. I went originally to York University for costume design because I'd been sewing a lot and always enjoyed making costumes for Halloween, had made costumes for a couple high school plays, that sort of thing. When I got to York, I was exposed to these new positions in theater, mainly TD and production management, technical director. I'm going to use a lot of acronyms and forget that no one knows what they mean. Technical director and production manager. And I was just drawn more to those roles because they dealt more with an overarching picture than with just one element of the show.
And those kind of roles, that would be like the one element would be, you're talking like specific designers maybe, or specific technicians?
Well, I went originally for costume, so yeah. Specifically costume, which would be one aspect of a show, whereas technical directors and production managers have to deal with all the aspects of the show.
Right, so like it's a bit nuanced, but what would be really the difference in tasks between you and a TD?
That is a question. The industry can't seem to iron that one out too distinctly. A lot of theaters or theater companies will actually merge the two and just call them a production manager. How it's sort of supposed to be is that the production manager deals with more of the budgeting, the hiring, firing. The TD is supposed to deal with specifically the technical troubleshooting, so would deal more with the lighting and sound departments, special effects, video. For example, myself, I don't have a large background in the technical aspects of theater. I have not done a lot of lighting hangs. I've not done a lot of stuff with audio systems. A lot of TDs have been house technicians and then switch to a management role, and that's the one that tends to appeal to them. So it is a very different set of skills. Usually TDs abhor paperwork. This is, again, big generalizations, right. And production managers live and breathe paperwork. So you do shortchange yourself a bit, A, in that you have one person trying to juggle all the technical problems of a show, and B, because they are often better at one of those jobs than the other. I haven't actually met anyone who says they're completely comfortable doing both. They will do both or will flip between the two, but they always have one they're more comfortable in.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. So Jasmine, what I thought was interesting there is, it sounds like a lot of people that go to theater school, they're right-brained individuals, they're creative types, you know, they want to express themselves and wake up at 10 a.m. This is the stereotype. But to become a manager like yourself, paperwork, timelines, that seems like the opposite personality type. It's the caricature of someone that goes to theater school. So is there a personality types that emerge, or how does that happen?
Well, I think there's different types of creative people. So production managers and TDs have to do a lot of creative problem solving, be it that the script has asked for something that I make this joke a lot of theater scripts that are movie scripts, where they do a thing and you're like, I have to do this in front of everyone. I can't cut and do special effects and add it in. Like, we've got to do this live. What do you mean the suitcase is full of water and or this thing erupts into fire or whatever? So often there are little tricks in the script or in the director's vision that need to be executed in some sort of creative madness way. And those get left to the production manager and the TD to figure out. So there is still a large creative aspect. It's just not the obvious creative outlet.
Right. That makes sense. The one thing, though, I wonder, though, is that it's, of course, there needs to be creativity in the jobs that you're describing, but just that ability to focus and meet the deadlines and be like, no, we can't have this burst into flames right now. Is that something that you have always had as a personality trait, or did you develop that through just work experience?
That's something I've always had, that I'm punctual, I hate being late. And I would honestly say, even in the most creative aspects of theater, everyone understands that we have a very hard deadline. Like, opening night is opening night. You don't change that unless someone's been like horribly injured or something. Even the more fluid theater roles, let's say, the less stringent ones, everyone's really aware that there are marks we have to hit, and opening night is opening night, and whatever shape the show is at that point, people have bought tickets.
Yeah, that was kind of, we went to school together for theater, and that was where we met. But I found personally that, like, those most creative people that were also just on top of being on time, meeting those deadlines, those ended up being the successful, even though they were the very creative types. And that's, I think that's reflected in your work experience, right?
Yeah, like, people don't show up late. Mm-hmm. There's just, I think that comes with liking your job as well. You understand that the call time is the call time. There are people relying on you. There's very rare roles in theater where people can move on without you there. So, like, there'll be certain rehearsal schedules where it's like, we only need 2 out of the 10 actors or whatever, because we're working on a specific thing. But for the most part, if you've been asked to be there, no one's there to fill in for you. So people get it ingrained pretty quickly that you are on time, you get stuff done according to the schedule, and that's your life in theater.
How diverse would the backgrounds of the people in these roles be? You mentioned that you didn't know you would have been doing this, whatever that was, you know, 5 or 10 years ago when you started school. So, yeah, I mean, I have a sense of what it's like in the field that Jared and I work in, data science. Like, there's a certain enrichment of individuals from backgrounds in that field. So I'm curious what it's like in your area.
There are certain areas that don't tend to cross over much. Like, usually there's a pretty hard divide between production and actors, for example. A lot of the diversity in theater comes from having to do whatever you can to get hired initially. So the more hats you can wear, the more likely you are to get hired. In tours, particularly, you could end up being the lighting designer, the sound designer, and the traveling TD. And honestly, I would say for actors too, the more things you have in your arsenal, the more likely they pick you out of the lineup of people. So a lot of times people don't specialize until they're more established, because then they can say, like, oh, I'm this person, I've done these designs, this is why you want me, as opposed to, I can do anything you need me to do, just please hire me so that I don't have to be a waitress.
Actually, that, I think, kind of segues a bit into the other thing I really wanted to know was, like, what do you think is the most important experience? If someone wanted to be, they came up to you and were like, I want to be a production manager for theater, this is my dream job, what do I need to do to get to that position?
I'm not really sure. Like, production managers come from a variety of different places in theater. Sort of the two routes people tend to take is either you go directly out of school into management, so then you'd get the entry-level management positions, which is like production assistant, which is basically code for gopher. You go get the things that no one else has time to get, and eventually you become maybe an assistant technical director, and then an assistant production manager, and then a production manager, which is what I did. Other people do come out of the technical side, so lighting, sound, and then decide they want to do management, because management is one of the few ways in theater where you can get things like benefits, a steady job with a set schedule, as opposed to whenever you're called. Yeah, just a bit more structure to your life. It is pretty all-consuming. I shouldn't make it sound like we've got a bunch of spare time or anything, but your life is a lot more
stable.
Yeah.
Actually, Jasmine, can I just jump in there quickly? There, it sounds like there could be actually a strong female tax in this industry, where if you need maternity leave or something like that, there's going to be a ceiling at which, past a certain age, you can't stay in this field. Do you see that happening? Do women tend to drop out of theater at a certain age just for practical purposes?
Yes and no. It is getting a lot better, but a bit of a side anecdote. Our friend Laura works at the Stratford Local, and she was only the third pregnant woman that's ever come through that local. That local's been around for decades.
Yeah, and that's she's with IATSE, which is, so she's more in the technician side.
Right? Yeah, yeah, juggling childcare and kids and just juggling a work-life balance is hard. A lot of theater happens when other people aren't at work, so evenings and weekends are sort of the territory. It's a choice you have to make. I will say, at a lot of times during tech weeks, people bring their kids along. There's definitely been times where it's like, okay, well, go up to the balcony, play with your toys. On breaks, you'll see your mom or your dad or whatever. Or like family members will bring the kids in on breaks and stuff like that. There are a lot of people making that work, but it's not an easy go, it looks like. And the kids tend to spend a lot of time with adults, it seems like.
Yeah. From my impression, from stories that you've told, though, is one of the good things about theater, I think, is that the community is small enough and that the interpersonal relationships tend to be strong enough that, like, that's okay, right? You can bring in your kids. People are understanding and are trying to do their best to be accommodating. At the end of the day, though, you still know that, like, this is when the theater show has to happen, because that's when the audience is going to come.
Yeah, theater is very much a community. You get really close with the people working on whatever show you're working on at the time, because in Tech Week, they're all you see. You're there from 8 a.m. till 11:30 midnight, rinse, repeat for the whole week, probably the week leading up to that. And the week after that, with previews and opening, your schedule is not much lighter. So we all kind of, it's like, oh, okay, well, this is your opportunity to see your kid. So, yep, your kid is going to be here at lunch. And that's great. And we all kind of, like, I know a bunch of people's kids, like, having worked with them a few times on shows. It's like, oh, okay, that's this designer's kids. Or, oh, that's the director's kids. Or this actress's kids. So, yeah, we all kind of.
You guys try and cover for each other. Yeah. So, I think one of the other things that I really wanted to talk with you about was this COVID pandemic, which is what everybody's talking about. In my mind, like, it seems to have hit theater particularly hard because of the social nearness requirements to participate as an audience member. What do you see that's been, like, the biggest challenge to theater in this time, and how has theater been able to cope with this right now?
So there's a few things that are affecting theater. When this first started, everything shut down. You weren't going to get an audience in, even if that was allowed. So a lot of theaters switched to doing some sort of online play reading, because a lot of theaters are funded through grants, and the grants are contingent on some sort of performance. So a lot of theater companies had to finish out their seasons doing basically like a rehearsed online play reading that people could watch from wherever. That's obviously not what theater wants to do long term, because that medium already exists through film and TV. That's not what theater wants to be doing. That is probably what theater will have to do for 2021. We hit a couple roadblocks in that if you can get together a show and you can rent a space or you own a space or whatever, there's a lot of information leading us to believe that the audiences are not comfortable coming out yet. There's also obviously overarching restrictions on capacity, which can make things very cost prohibitive. Theater venues do not operate in the same way that movie theaters do right now. We've been given a cap of 50 for the building, not each space. So, for example, the place I was working before this all went down has 4 theaters in the building, ranging from an audience capacity of 1,200 down to 200. So 50 people in the whole building does not make sense for us. We can't recoup our costs, and we can't put those costs all on the renter, because then they can't, they lose their shirt. So there's been a lot of talk of, oh yeah, you can only have 50 people in the building, but what about just filming it and having like a paywall, so there's this audience in the theater and this audience from home? And again, that's not why we do this. That's not what we want to do. As a desperation move, I'm sure many will do it. But the issue in figuring out a budget for that is that that's a completely untested market. We have no idea how many people want to pay for something like that and what their tolerance for a ticket price would be. So it's entirely experimental, which makes people understandably gun shy on doing a show.
Well, I remember just going to movie theaters, and so it seems like this business model has been attempted before, where they'll do like, it's the Globe Theater and you can see it at Cineplex, right? But just the frequency of those events, to me, I don't think it's a huge cash cow, because you'd only see that maybe like once every 6 months they'd even want to put it on.
Those things are a little bit different as well, in that your average person can't go see whatever at the Metropolitan Opera, or can't go see whatever show they're doing at the Globe. There's an aspect of like having to fly to that destination, the rather posh ticket price to get in. So those have even a bit of a leg up on a local Toronto theater, because they have that name and that pedigree associated with them. Like, they're a tourist destination, they're a thing in and of themselves. Whereas here, if this wasn't happening, you could go see something at Tarragon Factory, Canadian Stage. So why pay to see it from home? Which, again, like, those theaters have loyal audiences that want to see them through this. There will be people who pay for the content, or some theaters have come up with seasons that don't require anyone to pay for anything. Theater Center's doing an entire new work development season. Factory Theater's doing an entirely online, no ticket admission season. So we're seeing a lot of ways that people are adapting, but not a lot of ways that people are adapting to still have a ticket price.
Yeah, one of the questions I was going to ask, and you basically answered it, which was, why doesn't Broadway stream their shows? And the answer is, it's like, it's kind of apples and oranges here. We're talking about different markets, kind of different venues. That makes sense, what you've just told me. You mentioned that people here in like the local Toronto theater industry is concerned just about the uncertainty around the price, like how would this even work? But is there any fear that it would somehow like create a precedent for how things need to be in the future? Because my initial impression would be, well, there's nothing really else that can be done. Like, if it, you know, even if it's a loss making enterprise, it's better than the even further loss that would occur without it, right? Is it just like it's a sunk cost and they have to produce it? Or is there long run costs of doing this sort of suboptimal production?
I don't think anyone's worried about it setting a precedent, because as soon as we don't have to do this. I don't think many will continue doing it. I think what people are more worried about is you have to sink a certain amount of money into something before you can charge a ticket price for it. Like, most people are not going to charge a ticket price for a version of like an online play reading or something like that. You have to have an understanding of how much money you can recoup before you put money in. And a lot of these theaters toe a very tight line from year to year. Most of the theaters in Toronto are not for profit. So they don't have a nest egg to fall back on if this all blows up in their face. So there'll be a lot of people sort of doing these theoretical budgets on, okay, if we put this much money into a show that has this much production value, we should be able to charge a ticket price of this much and hope that it works.
How are those theaters that you just mentioned, though, able to offer then free subscriptions for online viewing? Like, aren't they going to go belly up if they do that? Don't they need to get some cost recovery?
So they've gotten specific grants in order to do that. So a lot of the theaters will say in their season announcements this year, oh, thanks to such and such bank for making this possible, or thank you to the Canada Council for giving us money towards new play development, or so basically it'll be, they get a set amount of money from government grants, their normal fundraising, that sort of thing, and they'll be doing a budget that does all of their in-house staff, their building costs, that sort of thing, factored into that, as well as a little bit towards each thing, with an understanding that what we're doing is free and is not a full-fledged production. You're not coming to see it in the theater. It's being shot in the rehearsal hall or whatever and broadcast to you. So this is the amount of money we can put into it. And they'll just be working their entire year budget into that money they get from grants and fundraising.
Are there some plays that you think are going to be better broadcast in kind of a more sparse setting? Like, you know, like, I don't know, an existentialist play or something? Do you have a sense of that?
There are shows that rely heavily on production, mainly shows that are happening in any sort of like realism environment. If you're doing a show in somebody's living room, it will be weird that you're doing the show on plastic folding chairs. There are shows that definitely the actors make the show and not the spectacle of what we put on top of that. So I'm sure people will be looking for scripts, A, with less, like smaller cast sizes, because you have to pay the actors. B, with more scripted actor prowess, so to speak, more heightened emotions and things that rely heavily on a really good actor instead of a really good set designer.
You're going to see a lot of Chekhov, is what you're saying.
Probably not. I have a feeling that would be quite boring to just watch people stand around saying that. They also have large casts.
That's true.
If you cut out the serfs, though, you could easily like have the production costs, I'm sure.
One concern that I think it's been a concern for theater for a number of years now, but it's like, so much of the subscriber base for so many of these theaters is very, like, has a median age that's quite old. With this kind of COVID pandemic, one of the things that theaters have always pushed for is to try and get young people into the shows in order to see it, to make them see the value of theater live in person. If this pandemic goes on too long where we're not able to kind of have these live shows, do you think that can maybe have an impact on like the viewer base in the long term?
My job does not interact with the audience much in A, getting them interested, or B, interacting with them once they're in. So I, like a marketing manager might be able to speak better to that, or, but my job does not deal with the audience much at all beyond making sure that we don't do anything on stage that makes them unsafe.
You know, Jared, that reminds me, I used to go to a lot of classical concerts before COVID started. And I don't know what the median age is for theater, but I can tell you the median age for a classical concert is at least 20 years higher. And so I wonder, do you have any sense of how the other art scenes have been faring, relatively speaking?
I've seen a lot of musicians put stuff out. Their online content is easier achievable. The issue is, of course, they can't all get together. Usually orchestras are huge. Mm-hmm. And also there's a lot of added restrictions for singers or wind instruments. You're supposed to be plexi separated off, and plexi is a large cost.
It's so, also fairly acoustically problematic, I thought.
I mean, it's not ideal. You don't mm-hmm. want to be doing your solo in a bus shelter, but if it's that or nothing, I suppose. So I've seen a lot of dance content online and a lot of musician content online. I don't know that they're getting any sort of financial gain from that. A lot of artists are doing things to just stay on the radar at the moment. Collecting SERB and just checking in with people and putting out content to make sure that there's a fan base when they get back.
One thing that seems different, someone who occasionally goes to the theater, whereas I often listen to classical music, you know, I'm more of a fan of classical music, but yet because it's so accessible, every recording I want is available, I think I would be less likely to pay to like hear the TSO perform, even if it's like live synced up, than I would be to pay a couple bucks to watch a theater production, because I can't find those on YouTube. I don't see them often. So I feel like there's just a scarcity of the product that other things that like especially music has to compete with right now.
Yeah, and I think there's people who are fans of seeing it in real life, the same as there are people who are fans of seeing theater in real life instead of spending that money to go to the movie theater to get their storytelling that way. So I think there's always going to be an audience for those things that want to see it, who want to be in the room with the musician doing the thing. Regardless of the fact that there are 20 recordings easily accessible on YouTube. And often, actually, the orchestras are throwing in some fun content. The last orchestra show I did at the recital hall, they did the Jaws theme. So you're like listening to the normal, what you're expecting from the concert, and then all of a sudden it's like, hold the phone. I'm pretty sure they're doing the Jaws theme. So They're throwing in some fun content in an attempt to get some younger audience members out and just to keep their audience base alive.
That is something I've always found interesting with theater, really, is like, I think there's been a precedent that said whenever they've made these huge blockbuster movies of like Chicago or Rent or whatnot, then all of a sudden the demand for tickets to see an entirely different production of it, imagined and staged differently, tends to go up with that because everyone has now been engaged with the film, but then they want to see it done just that slightly different and a different take on it.
My experience has been different, actually. There's the movie came out, then everybody buys tickets to the theater show expecting it to be the movie, but right in front of them, happening in real time. Like, we can't have two people standing on stage shooting Tommy guns into the air. There's a bunch of stuff that happens in those movies that we can't actually accomplish in real time right in front of you. They do benefit from scene changes like stop and start and cut this and edit this out. So yeah, my experience has actually been that they buy the tickets hoping that it is exactly what they've seen on TV.
I think we should go into the segment where whenever we have a guest on, we always like to get into kind of a fun, overrated or underrated.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think we're at the good halfway point now for this. All right, so feel free to pass on any of these or declare that they are accurately rated, Jasmine. So in no particular order, the importance of being earnest.
Oh, no, it is good. It is underrated.
Feel underrated, because I thought everyone loved it.
Yeah, you can love it more.
Excellent. How about Finch and Keel, or Finch West Station, whichever you're feeling?
Finch West Station. I mean, I feel like it's great that it exists. I've never been there.
No, I think that, is that Downsview?
That's right by York.
It's formerly known as Downsview, so you have been there.
I have been there, but not in like...
Not recently. Not since it was renamed.
Yeah, not in like 8 years. So I feel like it's probably made a huge difference in a lot of people's lives, but not mine.
Yeah, I definitely use it every day. All right, British Columbia.
I like it, but I think most people like it, so I think its rating is accurate.
Would you say that its official motto, the best place on earth, is an overstatement?
Probably.
That's fair.
I've been on vacation to places I would go back to and feel like it was more of a treat than going to British Columbia, I think.
Great.
Sorry, fine. BC boys.
Partially related, climbers, climbing.
I hate heights. So people who enjoy it, but I think it's overrated.
I think that's a sound observation. Original pronunciation, Shakespeare.
See, Shakespeare on the whole, I think, is just overdone. And most people will attempt to do some sort of crazy accent and just ruin the whole thing because you won't be able to understand what the heck they're saying.
I was going to ask what your favorite Shakespeare play was. I don't know if you want to add to that.
Nope. No, it's pretty much, I'm more interested if somebody's going to do something different with it than the play itself. Like, there isn't a Shakespeare play where I'm like, oh, I definitely want to go see another version of this. It's more, oh, someone's doing this show and they're doing something cool with it. I'll go see it.
So this next question I ask is someone who's a huge board games fan, but board game cafes, how does a real board games aficionado feel about those?
I like board game cafes because now that our board game shelves are filling up and we have to make our purchases with more care, I can go to the board game cafe with a list of things I've been thinking of maybe buying and pay $8 to sit there all day and play them and then pass-fail them. So I wouldn't say, like, if a bunch of friends want to get together and play board games, I'll say, like, just bring beers to my house and it will cost a lot less money and we'll play good games. But if I've got a list of games I'm thinking on buying, I love to go there and test them out.
Okay, great. Well, that's the end of overrated versus underrated. Yeah, so, you know, I heard you mention the CERB a couple of times, Jasmine. What's your sense of how well it's done? Are there big gaps in... like EI coverage for people in this sector?
So a lot of people who work in theater are gig workers or freelance, whichever term you want to put on it. So a lot of them do not qualify for any sort of EI. I would have qualified for EI, but it's also looking like I'm not going to be back at work till January or February. So CERB will end and then I will still need that EI. So I think that CERB has done a good job in offering something to a lot of people in this industry that would have had nothing, no jobs were hiring. Yeah, I don't think it was a perfect solution, but it definitely helped a lot of people out in the entertainment sector for sure.
And actually, let me throw this question at both of you. Has COVID changed your view of the need or the value of a basic income?
Well, yeah, I think... CERB has definitely brought up the topic of universal basic income a lot. It seems to do well in the places where it exists. And I know there's a lot, like in the entertainment industry, there's sort of seasons of feast or famine. Most of the summer, no one's doing anything, and you've had to budget whatever you've made the rest of the year to get you through that time. So these are people who would get jobs in their industry and would continue working through the summer if there was someone doing something to hire them. They're not lazy, unmotivated people who want to sit back and just get money, but there's no opportunities in their field for a good 3 months, I would say. And film is the same. Film shuts down for very specific time periods as well. So for my industry, for sure, people would benefit from that. And then we'd have a lot less people just completely disappear from theater because they're having a hard time getting their start in it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think it's piqued my interest the most in seeing what the metrics we've been able to measure as CERB's been given out will say. Before this, I was certainly very pro-UBI, and I think I still am, but I've also seen anecdotes of people who have then kind of decided to just sit on CERB for the entire time that it's being handed out and not actually try and work so much. And
that's tricky, though. One devil's advocate to that is that a lot of the jobs being offered during this time have been part-time minimum wage jobs, and you'd actually make less money doing that than getting CERB.
Yeah, and I wanted to say that I just wasn't sure what the reasons for a lot of that was, how prevalent that actually is, and I don't know if that's going to be like a long-term trend or if people were even just, those people who made that decision was really more of a pandemic kind of instantiated reason and not necessarily what you would expect if this was normal times. So I'm a lot more interested in seeing the data and looking at kind of the outcome for it, though I would still say that I've remained quite pro UBI. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I like the UBI just because it's so clean and it's so unconditional. There's no judgment. This is like a big ongoing debate in economic policy making, right? Do you want rules or do you want judgment? And I always favor rules over judgment. And the UBI seems the most extreme form of that, so I'm naturally drawn towards it. It has a very powerful impact on labor markets, which are undeniable, which is it will certainly change the composition of the Canadian economy, right? So there's just a large sector of the economy which depends on wages near the lower bound of like people's reservation for coming into the labor market. And so, for example, a UBI without an increase in, say, temporary foreign workers program would completely change Canadian agriculture because some crops wouldn't become economic overnight. And maybe that's fine. Maybe we move to a higher production value agricultural sector. I just think there would be lots of impacts. So I don't discount anyone who pushes back against it for the changes that it would cause, because I think it would have big effects. So Jasmine, Jared and I work in AI, that was in quotation marks. I was wondering, do you have any sense if AI could help with the arts or theater? What are some ways you could imagine that being useful?
There's been some sort of dabbling in that kind of thing with, like, they've tried to do follow spots that don't need operators. It seems like a lot of the initiatives that it could be applied to for theater would be to try to eliminate jobs, which is unfortunate. Like, the things that pop into my head are, yeah, follow spots that wouldn't need an operator, or the same sort of thing like a projector that could take cues a bit differently so that it didn't need an operator. We do use automation, so that requires some level of, maybe not what would be considered AI, but definitely computer programming. So yeah, if it wasn't being used to eliminate people's jobs, it would be used to do fancy tricks so that the audience didn't understand how we accomplished something.
The Needles and Opium production that came here many years ago now, and they had some impressive image processing, and it didn't have neural nets or anything in their back end, I'm sure, but they were definitely able to get the projector to recognize a human body and be able to cut that out of the projection in order to project all of the surfaces onto this kind of inverted cube, which the actors would stand on, and that could rotate in order to do all the different scenes. And that, I think, yeah, there's an example of like cutting edge technology. Yes, it doesn't have what we now think of as like deep learning involved in it, which is kind of the real, when someone says AI, they're usually talking about deep learning in the current discourse. But a lot of that visual computing was very, very cutting edge and probably wasn't invented until the early 2000s. So
I did do a show with an Android in it once. she did scare the heck out of me when I went into the theater at the end of the night the one day and forgot that there would be a very person-looking thing sitting in a chair in the middle of the space. But that was, yeah, that was for Spotlight Japan, where we got in a bunch of shows from Japan and did a festival at Berkeley Street. So there was a show with two robots and a show with an android in it.
Let me pitch a play right now. What about this? We train an algorithm to read through every Chekhov work, you know, whatever, turn of the century stuff, and then we get it to generate a completely AI from scratch script. Could this help theater recover?
I mean, if you could explain it to the audience base so they understood what the play was going to be, I guess, maybe.
No, that's the surprise. That's the exciting part. AI completely generated. People come, they don't know what to expect. Will it be the best play ever?
You'd have to have a large subscriber base who trusts you to begin with to pull that one off, I think. We say in theater you need the sure things, and then you have to mix the experimental stuff in with that. Some theaters follow that rather religiously, and other theaters decide to do entirely experimental and hope they still have their shirt at the end of the day. It could work.
It reminds me actually of classical concerts where, you know, they'll say, you know, Rachmaninoff's third piano concerto that night, and then they'll sneak in to the production like a 10-minute piece by the in-house Canadian composer who no one's heard of before. So it even happens within classical music, so that makes sense.
So that's something that I've always thought was great about Canadian theater. It's small enough, and it's not mass distributable like television and film, in such a way that you really get a truly Canadian or a local identity. Those have always been some of the most moving theatrical pieces that I've seen, have been new works done telling Toronto stories or telling Vancouver stories. I think if COVID has some kind of a long-term effect on theater, my hope is that it's those kind of pieces that are unaffected and are able to stay in the mainstream and stay in the theater ecosystem. Just because that, to me, has always been the most important value that theater brings to any kind of artistic landscape.
Yeah, I have one last non-theater question. So, you know, we've talked a lot about theater this interview, and it's been great. I feel like we've really dived into some of the details. I've learned a lot. I think I'll need to even re-listen to it just to keep track of some of the technical things you discussed. But, you know, outside of theater and board games, which we briefly touched upon, what are some of your other interests, Jasmine? I'd love to hear about those.
I like to read. After I finished the book I'm reading now, I've reached my Goodreads goal for the year, because I've been unemployed and have a lot more time on my hands.
Yeah, and what was that goal? How many?
48 books.
Yeah, that's a lot of books.
Four a month. That's good.
I like to sew. I like to do a lot of crafty stuff. I joke a lot that I turned my hobbies into a career.
What's the ratio of fiction to nonfiction?
Mostly fiction. I do enjoy historical fiction that is more historical than fiction. It's like, you know, just jazz it up a little, but I want to learn something. But I also lean rather heavily towards sci-fi and fantasy as well.
Would this be like a Young Victoria type thing where, you know, you take Queen Victoria's life and then just kind of add some dramatic flair around the presumable events that would have occurred?
Yeah, sure. Or Ken Follett does a series on the First and Second World War. So like you get a pretty good overarching, like this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened, but told from characters that are completely made up. So that kind of thing I like, where it's like you've made these characters so that this story can be a bit more dramatic and story-like, but I'm actually learning about this series of events as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think for some people, even myself at sometimes, like, if you don't have the human narrative at the center of a story, there's only so much you can just accept these, like, history as trends phenomena. It just becomes a bit much after a while.
And often a lot of the, like, I've read some biographies that I enjoyed, but I read a book, I forget what it's called, but it was about a bunch of real women who ended up in the camps during the Second World War. So like, it's very interesting and horrifying material, but it was presented in this very like fact way. So it's like, it's really horrifying, but I'm so bored because this is just so dry. So as soon as I think people have the artistic liberty to be like, this person existed and did these things on top of these big scary events happening.
I think it's related just to humans' ability to empathize just taps out at a certain number of people. It's kind of like a sigmoid function. It saturates very quickly. You tell someone that, 100 people died, sad to hear about it. You revise the number to 500. People aren't five times as sad. At a certain point, numbers just become arbitrary. They're just placeholders, really.
And I'm in an industry that heavily favors storytelling. So mm-hmm. I like a bit of drama in my reading material.
Also on the topic of books, I want to spin it. I wasn't going to ask it like this, but I'd like to spin it this way. You've talked with Eric for a little bit this podcast. If there was a book that you could recommend to him, what book would you tell Eric to read next?
Oh, God. I'm one of those people that as soon as you say, like, what would you recommend of this? I can suddenly not think of a single book I've read or a single TV show I enjoyed. Like, I can't handle these types of questions.
What have you given 5 stars to on Goodreads this year?
Yeah.
Oh, like almost nothing.
Right. Yeah. So then last year.
No, I give a lot of 4 stars. Like, I basically have to not be able to put the book down before I can give it 5 stars.
Did anything get 5 stars, though, this year?
I don't think anything did this year. I've read some good Stephen King books. I really like how he drives the narrative. He usually drops the ball on the ending, though. The ending usually really, really bothers me. So then I can't give 5 stars.
So then how about, do you have a favorite book that you...
I don't have a favorite anything.
I don't have a favorite anything.
No, because, like, again, you can't pick... Like, whenever people ask those questions on, like, what are you bringing to the desert island, I'm like, I would be frozen with indecision. I would stand there staring at my bookshelf and then be teleported to the island with nothing.
Oh, dear.
I'm completely the same. One thing I've done instead of having, like, what a favorite book is I have, what are books that had a strong impact on me, like, one way or the other, like, career choices, like, topics I'd never thought about. I have, like, I think that the top row of my bookshelf is, like, books that were formative to me when I was young or going into science for the first time. So I think that's also a useful way to categorize books, too.
Yeah, whenever I've been forced to answer the island question, I usually just pick a book like Dune or something because it's huge.
Well, you could take the Wheel of Time, then.
The whole series?
Yeah, well.
Oh, okay, done. That'll take some time to read.
The last thing that I wanted to ask you, because I know you have a lot of stories from your career, can you share with us one anecdote that you might say is one you enjoy telling the people the most?
All right. My job is weird, so I do end up with a lot of crazy stories. But one of the ones that I guess holds the most shock value is when I was working at Cannes Stage, we did a show where the designer asked for a boat for set dressing. And for those who don't know, set dressing is just there for decoration. It is not called for in the script, nor is it interacted by actors. It is just there for the visual. So I was like, we can't afford an entire boat just for the aesthetics of it. And the director of the show was like, well, I bike past 2 boats. That just like sit on the side of the highway on my bike to York. He's like, I can tell you where they are. Sure, like we'll come check out these random side of the highway boats. So me and the TD at the time and an IATSE crew. So I was driving the company van with a crew of like 6 people in the van. And then the TD was driving a 5-ton rental truck. And we drove to the side of the highway in North York, and sure enough, there were 2 boats with nothing around. So it wasn't like these are buddy's boats that he's just like set slightly off of his property. It's like, we are near no one. I have no idea where these boats have come from. So we stuck one of them in the back of the 510 and drove back to the theater. So now I like to tell people that I commandeered a boat. It ended up getting hung from the ceiling and looked really cool.
Speaking of anecdotes, you mentioned that opening night has to happen, the show must go on. If you are allowed to discuss it, what is the most disastrous opening night that you were witness to?
It would take a lot for me to call something a disaster. I think I have to preface with that. Yeah, I don't think we've had opening night disasters. We've had things happen during the runs of shows. We've had actors get food poisoning, which you cannot keep going. You must stop. We had, during the last preview of one show, we had these big moving walls, like 20-foot high moving walls, and one of them jumped its track. So like, it's unsafe. You have to call the show. You have to tell everyone to like, go get a drink. We've got to figure something out. Lucky you, you get this like magical insight into the backstage process. We had a blackout when we were doing Shakespeare in Hyde Park. So again, like all the lighting goes out. You have to like usher the audience out of the park with flashlights. Or Blythe once had a cow in one of their shows and it was acting very strange, but you can't do anything about it. It's a cow. So the show went on. And at the end of the show, one of the farmers in the audience, because it's Blythe, the audience always has at least one farmer in it, came up and said, so your cow's in labor. So this farmer and two of the technicians on the show had to birth a cow in the middle of a two-show day. And then the show in the evening had a cow and a cat.
Wow. That's a great story.
Some pretty off-the-wall stuff connected.
That would never happen at SickKids. I don't think we'd ever see a cow give birth. Just something we're missing out on.
Yeah, that would be a very strange day.
Thank you to Jasmine for being on this episode of the podcast. And thank you for listening. This has been the 7th episode of the Statistically Insignificant Podcast.